Dr. Amelida's presentation was actually a very good introduction to the last slot of this panel.
I knew that.
Of course. Very excellent presentation. By the way, let me just upload my slides. Because I think the key word is everything is about US dollar. That. Excellent. So for the last slot of this panel, I think the idea of Professor Bonomi and the other organizer, obviously, thanks a lot for having me today. It's a great honor to speak in front of this very distinguished audience, was to allocate this slot to a practitioner, having slightly a different view, if I may say so. And basically, the idea was for me to share with you my meeting with a tiger, with a very dangerous tiger, not only my meeting, but the meeting of my clients and several of my clients. Who is this tiger? It's the United States Department of Justice. I will tell you about the US DOJ program for Swiss banks, the so-called Swiss bank program. I would assume many of you have heard about the Swiss bank program, but nevertheless, I have divided basically my presentation into mainly two parts. The first part will be a little bit of description, the key characteristic of the programs, in particular for those who are less familiar with the Swiss bank programs. And after, the most important part, I hope, of the presentation will be sharing with you a few lessons that I've learned, that my clients, Swiss banks, have learned into this quite difficult experience of participating to this US program, and a few perspectives in terms of opening the discussion at the end, which I suppose will be very interesting. So the US DOJ program, what are we talking about? Around 2008, the Department of Justice started to get very interested into the behavior of Swiss banks, who allegedly had helped US taxpayers to avoid taxes. Obviously, first case, the UBS case in 2008, and a few other banks were put in investigation after 2008 until this very strong day that Thomas Vernon mentioned this morning, the indictment of the Swiss bank Voegelin. At that point in time, it very much became a political problem because the Swiss authorities and the Swiss banking industry were very much concerned that one bank after the other would be placed under investigation by the DOJ. And then there was quite quickly the understanding that there need to be a global resolution for the entire dispute, a global framework for resolving the potential criminal liability of all Swiss banks who had US undeclared assets. So this is basically how the US bank program came to life in mid-2013. It was an unprecedented initiative from the US Department of Justice. As I mentioned, very much a negotiated solution between the Swiss and the US authorities, or even the program, and you have that in the documentation, you have the actual program. It's a completely unreadable document, so don't even spend time. But you see on the top of the program a document called a joint declaration, which is a joint declaration of the two countries, the two authorities, explaining what was the rationale of this framework resolution for the banks. Massive impact. More than 100 Swiss banks entered at the same time into this framework resolution program, more or less, and Professor Emmenegger would know the exact number, but I think we have 330 Swiss banks in Switzerland, so it's of course very significant. So very significant impact, and I think unprecedented, but also never replicated so far. No other jurisdiction has received this treatment, and this so-called tool has not been used, I think, in the past. So key characteristic about the program. So as I mentioned, the idea was to allow to resolve the criminal liabilities in the US for the Swiss banks. The criteria that was so complicated for Swiss bankers to understand was the bank that would enter into the program were the banks who would have reasons to believe that they had committed tax-related offense. We will come to that in a second. And one important criteria as well, the banks who were already under investigation, more or less 10 or 13 at that time, could not benefit from this new framework resolution. So this is at that point in time, August 2013, that this new language, very much used in the industry afterwards, derived the category banks. Category one banks, those precisely are the ones who could not benefit from the framework resolution. The category two banks, those are the ones I will talk about today, those are the ones who entered into the program. And the two other categories are a little bit less relevant. The category three bank was actually quite interesting. It initially provided for the possibility to enter also into the program, but by saying I have not done nothing wrong. I will disclose whatever I have to disclose. And in the end, you will tell me somehow that I'm fine. And I will get some document. This, for quite obvious reasons, was not very attractive, because entering into a discussion with the Department of Justice and saying, I have done nothing wrong, is obviously quite a dangerous path. And you will see afterwards it was not successful at all. But the Category 2 bank program was very, very successful. So released in August 2013, the banks had until the 31st of December 2013 to decide whether or not to join this program. Each single Swiss bank, I can tell you, between August and December, entered into an exercise of looking into its books, identifying the past conduct, hiring US counsel. I think that the service between Washington, D.C. and Geneva and Zurich have never been as successful as between August and December. It was full of U.S. lawyers all the time, who were basically providing a preliminary assessment and a recommendation to the banks as to whether or not they should join the program. FINMA had also a role in that regard. And almost every bank filed in the middle of the night, 31st of December, the letter saying, I want to get into this program. Extraterritorial law, this is the topic of the panel, this is what it is. Those are the tax-related offenses that the DOJ considered that the Swiss banks in Zurich and in Geneva, even not having left Zurich and Geneva, had committed during all those years. List of the tax-related offenses that you can also see in more details in the non-prosecution agreement. I'll come to that, but everything is very public. You can find all the information about the program on the website of the DOJ. And in addition, also some offenses regarding unreporting monetary transactions, the FBAR, the requirement to disclose foreign bank accounts, or a set of offenses that are relevant. So what basically does it entail to the Swiss banks when they entered into the program? A lot of work. Complete disclosure of their cross-border activity. Practically, entering into an internal investigation over the activities of the bank with regards to US clients over the previous 10 years, provided detailed information on an account-by-account basis, significant work. This word disclosure, very new for the Swiss banks, but the amount of disclosure, I'll explain to that a little bit later, is enormous and is still the case. It's still ongoing today. Cooperation in treaty request, also kind of a new concept. The idea of the program was the Swiss will basically provide the DOJ with the material that would allow the DOJ to send back administrative requests under the 1996 convention. So it's really, I put some summaries, I put some information and send that to the DOJ, and then DOJ can send back the administrative request, and then I have to provide to the Swiss authority, so I can provide name of clients. That was the idea. It was basically to go around banking secrecy, indirectly provide name of clients through this cooperation in treaty requests. Provide information on transaction, key aspect, quite clever idea from the DOJ to force the banks to provide framework information on transactions, where the funds have left when a US client has closed his accounts in the difficult years. So all information as to which other banks had received, so DOJ could, it's probably what they are doing today, have put together those giant spreadsheets of millions of pages and are tracing really the flow of funds of the American clients at the Swiss banks. Two other interesting points, a requirement to hire an independent examiner. What is an independent examiner? It's, as I think probably all of you know, very often in the US, in this type of proceeding, you might have, after the conclusion of a non-prosecution agreement, a monitor, which is probably the nightmare of any company who has entered into a non-prosecution agreement. Under the program, it's a little bit a soft monitor, who was required to somehow attend the ongoing work done by the bank and to perform a guarantee to the DOJ that the work done by the bank was basically in line of the requirements of the program. Last but not least, pay a penalty at the end. And in exchange of all this, getting the famous non-prosecution agreement that you can find on the website of the Department of Justice. Many challenges faced by the Swiss bank, starting by the fact that the Swiss authorities had mentioned to the US that the Swiss banks could participate in full respect of Swiss law without any difficulty. We will see it was actually much more complicated than that, and we had to face difficulties with Swiss law constraints almost on a daily basis, and we are still facing such type of difficulties today. Huge impact of huge issues with disclosure. Why? The disclosure involved a very important number of names of banking employees and of third parties. We are talking thousands and thousands of names that the banks were forced to disclose. Here, obviously, we had all the mechanism of the Data Protection Act, which is very strict in Switzerland, who entered into play. At the very beginning, we were not even exactly sure what mechanism would apply, and here we had to follow the guidance of the préposé de la protection des données, the person in charge at the federal level on data protection issue, who provided some guidance in terms of proceeding. So a full requirement to get consent from the people, and as you can imagine, it's not very easy to contact an employee of the bank and tell him, listen, I have to disclose your name to the DOJ, but everything will be fine, don't worry, it's a requirement for the bank. I will take care of everything that will happen. I can tell you those led to very interesting discussions. And just for information, a leading decision from the Swiss Federal Tribunal, which is actually very recent, it's kind of interesting that no decision took place actually during the program, which basically reached the conclusion that there is no overriding interest for the disclosure of this information. So it somehow put an end to the disclosure without the consent of the person. Obviously the DOJ is not very happy with this decision, but this is the strict application of Swiss law, and it's rather a good decision. In the interest of time, I don't spend too much time because I will come to the other challenges during the second part. Just a few key numbers that I think are interesting. 106 banks entered category 2, 80 got an NPA. What happened with the 26? It's not that they did not get it, it's that they managed to withdraw from the program with kind of a negotiated withdrawal by considering that they had in fact not violated US law, but without any guarantee against future prosecution. And here you see the category 1 bank. This is still ongoing. The program is not over for the category 1 bank. Already very significant amount in terms of penalty that have been already been paid. Interesting to see from the category 2 banks, 106 and only 1.36 billion, so obviously much lower. But this was also the benefit of the program, to benefit from somehow lower rates in terms of penalty. And as I mentioned, not a success of the category 3, only 5 banks entered into this category. A few more numbers, penalty numbers, quite important, of course. And here I've tried to put in this chart something that I think is interesting, is the ratio between the US assets under management. This is what you have here in the gray columns. And this is, and it's of course in billion. And here you see the penalty paid by all of the 15 largest penalties in million. BSI is actually the first bank that has reached an NPA very early in the program, and it's also the bank who has paid the most, so I'm not sure it was that of a good deal, but this is the first bank. And you see the discrepancy between the number, the ratio in terms of AUM and the penalty amount. Kind of interesting, the difference also between one situation and the other. Particularly interesting, and we will get to that later, the program provides for a calculation method for the penalty, so very strict, at least initially we thought was a very strict calculation method. Lessons learned. First, the key strategic decision for a Swiss bank who took the decision to enter into this program was, what will be my attitude? And as you can imagine, for a Swiss bank who does not particularly like to enter into dealings with a foreign authority, they were very afraid by entering into some kind of discussion with the Department of Justice. So there were many strategies that had been considered. One strategy was, we will play it the Swiss type, which will be by the book, we will be very strict, or we will do it the US type, which will be much more, I need a little bit of water. The US style, which will be full cooperation. Another interesting lesson, the role and the relationship with US prosecutors. That was a new world, and clearly a cultural shock, as you can imagine. For Swiss banks, entering into this kind of informal discussion with US prosecutors was extremely special, extremely difficult. Alternatives to full cooperation. Are there really alternatives to full cooperation? I think you have received the answer quite early this morning by Thomas Verlaine. The only alternative was death sentencing. There is no alternative. MLAT, very difficult discussion. Mutual legal assistance request. When you talk with the DOJ in a criminal matter and you tell them, if you want to get this evidence, it has to be through mutual legal assistance, I can tell you it's almost an insult. And you are lucky if you are not out of the room immediately. The US DOJ does only consider mutual legal assistance in criminal matters as the very, very, very ultima ratio, the very last resort. What they want is getting direct information from the party, irrespective of where the party is located. They want direct information, direct cooperation. And those type of, really, those type of discussion with the prosecutors in this somehow, let's say the environment of a meeting with DOJ has nothing to do with the environment of a hearing in Geneva, in Zurich, in Lausanne with a prosecutor. Here it's extremely formal. You get into the room. It's almost cold in terms of the atmosphere. And this is our system, our criminal procedural law system. All the investigatory work is conducted by the Swiss prosecutor. He is the one deciding, asking the question, doing all the work. You are just assisting the party. So for a Swiss bank, suddenly being in this conference room in the government building in Washington, D.C., with those prosecutors that go by first name, already quite a shock for the Swiss bankers, and entering into this kind of informal discussion, the first 5 minutes about the kids and about the news and about other things, and then suddenly speaking about the liability of the bank in criminal matters, and also the fact that the tone was always very cordial. Huh? The tone is never aggressive in some cases, but it's actually very rare. When the client, in most cases actually only the lawyers attend those meetings with the prosecutors, when it has to become a little bit more aggressive, as lawyers you receive the message, feel free to communicate to your client. And this is a threat. But this is still a very informal discussions. So as I said, MLAT, this is clearly not a possibility. In the context of the program, it had been dealt with, but on other matters, you cannot even consider MLAT. This is the worst choice. The independent examiner, I've already said a few words about him, but the key strategic question at the very beginning was who will the bank appoint? A US independent examiner, a European, a Swiss one, a law firm, a forensic accountant? All those decisions were very important because the Swiss bank was so afraid of getting a third party accessing all the information, and rightly so, I think. The Swiss bank considered the independent examiner as a little bit an extra arm of the DOJ, so quite a difficult decision. In one of my cases, we found, quite a good solution. We hired a U.S. law firm, and we had a U.S. white-collar practitioner lawyer as being the actual independent examiner. But all the actual work at the bank was performed by the Swiss offices, and in fact, in that case, the German offices of the same law firm. So for the bank, it was the comfort of having people they were closer to in terms of culture, and having those people at the bank felt a little bit more usual. You can imagine also that when the bank started to see this huge number of US lawyers invading the building, they were very afraid of that. I mean, I remember often situations where my clients told me, but is this lawyer the DOJ or is this lawyer working for us? It was so new, and the main reason why it was so different is that those US lawyers initially have conducted an investigation at the bank in order for the law firm to report the results of the conduct to the DOJ. So suddenly you had employees of the bank sitting in a conference room at the bank answering questions of the lawyers of the bank. This was a new world, a new environment. They were absolutely not used to that, and we had to train, to explain them, and then hear the relationship between the Swiss and the US law firm was so important. The Swiss law firm was very often very closely involved because it was the link between those unknown US lawyers and the actual Swiss employees, and very much the teamwork between the Swiss law firm and the US law firm was a key criteria. Some further lessons, importance of disclosure. As I mentioned, significant disclosure. We are speaking about millions, millions, millions of pages. And why important? Because very much disclosure, I'm sorry to have to say so, it's about quantity and not about quality. You are attending these meetings with DOJ and you hear, how many pages do you plan on producing? We want at least 20,000. Without even asking, what about 20,000 pages? But we can produce 20,000 of blank pages, so it's completely irrelevant. But quantity impacts the characterization of the cooperation. If you want to provide excellent, extraordinary cooperation, it's about quantity. So the number of disclosure, it's millions in French. I would say c'est un nombre de papier that has to be fed by the banks and by any entity under investigation. Calculation of the penalty amount. Swiss banks thought, this is a program, it's like statutory law, we're very comfortable, we can play it by the book, or everything is written, that will be very easy. The calculation of the penalty amount could have been the easiest part because it's actually a percentage of the asset under management on the undeclared account. I am not aware of one single bank whose internal calculation ended being the same as the amount paid and calculated by the auditor. So we have no idea how it has been calculated on DOJ side, no idea. We shared a lot of information on the population of account, but in the end, we always receive the information, it will be arranged. And we ask, how can it be arranged if we are doing an account by account exercise with percentage? How can it be arranged? So that's an unresolved questions. Swiss law, very few words on that. Lots of restrictions, banking secrecy. We spent hours and hours at the DOJ explaining the difficulties of banking secrecy, the need to obtain waivers of the client to disclose specific information, the data protection mechanism, and frankly, the attitude of the Department of Justice publicly in conferences. Very often, the Department of Justice was saying in conferences, we are respecting Swiss law, no problem at all. But this is not always the echo that we had in meetings where they said, okay, we want that, and you have to find a way to accommodate the Swiss law requirements. Magnitude of post-NPA cooperation, the program is over. There is a post-NPA cooperation of 4 years. As of today, banks are receiving more requests than before they got the NPA. Requests, unlimited requests of cooperation in almost all different fields. And the type of request that you can get is also sometimes unrelated to the initial tax dispute. So you get a phone call from the DOJ saying, hey guys, you've heard about Panama Papers? Does it ring a bell? I say, yeah, sure, Panama Papers. We know about Panama Papers, but what has this to do with the tax dispute? Oh, we just would like to know if you have something to do with Mossack Fonseca. And then the Swiss bank considers, I can maybe provide, because I might be required to do so under my post-NPA cooperation requirement, provide information on U.S. clients having used Mossack Fonseca, but not on French clients or German clients. This is a completely different story. So we have to be a little bit focused. And those are the type of discussions that are ongoing at the moment and not very easy. And as I mentioned, the disclosure, it's really ongoing. At the end, it's almost like the Swiss banks would have produced all documents on their account population. So it's quite a very significant exercise. Last point on the statement of facts. You can find that also on the DOJ website. Each bank had to sign a statement of facts, which is a description of the bad conduct of the bank. Also, there are a few difficulties actually now on the statement of facts. First, this public admission of past wrongdoing is not very much in the habit of Swiss banks to have this becoming very public. And because this is public, the bank has received some further inquiries from third-party business partners, other banks in which it was, other non-Swiss banks, to confirm that the bad conduct had been remediated, that this was an old story. And last but not least, very recently, the Swiss banks have received questions, or some Swiss banks at least, of FINMA on the statement of facts, which is quite unimaginable when you think about it, because FINMA was, as a bank regulator, the entity who has almost pushed the bank into the program, let's be very clear, and now, 18 months after the end of the program, starts to ask questions about the statement of facts. The problematic aspect is the statement of facts has been, to some extent, drafted by the banks, but very much to another extent drafted by DOJ without almost any possibility to amend the wording. So those questions, discussion now, are in my view quite problematic. I have to conclude. So one, let me just choose one of them. Strong impact on the Swiss legal industry, in my view, an interesting one from my practitioner point of view. It has changed the legal industry. First, obviously, very significant matters for many law firms in Switzerland. But also, As we have mentioned several times today, we are not used to discovery, all these aspects, even the technological aspect. So I've very often I have seen the Swiss Bank program as a catch-up course in e-discovery techniques and all those things. And clearly, I think now we are almost a little bit in advance in comparison to some of our immediate neighbors in terms of the use of technology in large litigation, which is becoming more and more important, in particular in criminal matters. And my last word would be, this was a good example, but this is not the only one in terms of international cooperation. The French prosecutors, roughly at the same time, have said, what the US prosecutor managed to do to the Swiss bank, there is no reason why we would not manage to do the same. Thank you for your attention.